now ready to hear argument from Relator, National Tank Company versus Brotherton.
May it please the court, Mr. Brown and Mr. McCleary will present arguments for the petitioners. Mr. Brown will open. Mr. McCleary has reserved 8 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Gerald Brown, and I and my partner, Mr. McCleary, are here today to argue on behalf of the Relator National Tank Company, most often referred to as NATCO in this original mandamus proceeding. This proceeding raises issues regarding the attorney-client privilege, the attorney work product privilege, and in addition, the party communication and witness statements privileges. At the outset, I think it is worth noting what NATCO is not claiming it's entitled to do in this mandamus proceeding. That is, NATCO is not claiming that it's entitled to somehow hide facts in the course of the discovery process. All NATCO is attempting to do is protect privileged communications. The persons with whom those privileged communications were conducted are well known to the real parties in interest. They have had every opportunity to take the depositions of those individuals, and have in fact taken the depositions of most, if not all, of those individuals. They were fully entitled, and they availed themselves of their right to question those individuals as to what they saw, heard, smelled, whatever, on the day of the accident. By way of example, most of the internal investigation conducted by NATCO was conducted by Henry Townsend. Henry Townsend works, and at the time worked, in the legal department of NATCO. His immediate supervisor and superior was Alan Peets, the general counsel of NATCO.
Now, Townsend was not a lawyer, though.
He is not a lawyer. That is correct. Mr. Peets could not conduct the investigation personally, so he dispatched Mr. Townsend, who worked in the legal department, to conduct it in his stead. It is uncontroverted that Mr. Townsend reported directly to Mr. Peets and that his communications were confidential. And Mr. Peets has stated in his affidavit that he conducted this investigation so that he could render legal services to NATCO. He is both the general counsel and the secretary of NATCO. Now, when Mr. Townsend's deposition was taken, interjections were not interposed as to what Mr. Townsend personally saw or heard, aside from privileged communications, when he visited the Wichita Falls facility, or what he smelled, or in general, what he perceived as a fact witness. The only objections that were interposed were with respect to his privileged communications with the general counsel, Alan Peets, and with other employees of NATCO in the course of the investigation that Mr. Peets ordered him to undertake and whose instructions Mr. Townsend was following.
Let me clarify that. If he smelled something and told it to Peets, it was privileged, but if he smelled something and didn't tell it to Peets, you let him testify about it?
No, sir. If he smelled something, he could testify about it.
Regardless of whether he told it to Peets?
Yes, if he was asked whether he told Mr. Peets what he smelled, that was objected to, because that would be a confidential communication. Now, we believe that Judge Brotherton abused his discretion and committed some fundamental legal errors in several areas. First, with respect to attorney work product. Judge Brotherton's
counsel,
order.
Just one follow-up, excuse me, before you get away from that question while I'm thinking of it. What if he smells something and he puts it in a report and he sends it to several people, one of them is an attorney?
Depends on who the other people are, Mr. Justice.
Well, other people in the company.
If he is sending it to the other people confidentially so that they can assist in providing legal advice, assist Mr. Peets or outside counsel in providing legal advice, that would still be privileged. Well, if he's just sending it to them because as a business communication and it's not with as part of rendering legal services, then that arguably would destroy any privilege that might otherwise have been there.
If he's not, if he basically just copies the attorney or lists an attorney as one of the addressees, is that enough?
If the underlying communication is simply a business communication, I do not believe that simply copying the attorney on what is otherwise an underlying business communication is sufficient.
If it is a report of an accident that is directed to an attorney as the first addressee, but is prepared in the ordinary course of business of reporting on every incident, does that make it privileged?
I believe the distinction there is whether the communication is maintained as confidential with the attorney. I know of no law in Texas that says routine attorney-client communications are not privileged, and there's certainly nothing in Rule of Civil Evidence 503 that would intimate that to be the case. So even if it's a routine communication with the attorney to facilitate the attorney in rendering legal services, that is protected by the attorney-client privilege so long as it is a confidential communication. I think the key would be whether copying various other people, possibly for non-legal reasons, would destroy the confidentiality of the communication.
Insofar as you rely upon investigative privileges, and you say that you proved your privilege by the affidavit of Mr. Pease, I suppose it was his affidavit as I recall, that litigation was virtually certain. That only proves one element of the Flores test, does it not? His subjective knowledge?
Well, I think the courts of appeals have, to some degree, split on that. Let me say, as an initial matter, Flores, of course, only addressed party communications and did not address attorney work product. But the courts of appeals have split as to whether the totality of the circumstances, including the circumstances of the underlying incident or accident, may provide an objective prong to support the subjective belief.
Well, you're saying then, in essence, that, for example, in Stringer, the train wreck with bodies strewn all over the track, that this court was wrong when it said that the defendant there could not reasonably anticipate litigation.
With respect, I believe it was. We said in our brief that there can be an underlying event. The example we used in the brief was the crash, say, of a jumbo jet killing all 500 people aboard. And to say that the airline whose jet crashed has only a subjective belief that litigation is going to ensue, with all due respect, I think, blinks reality. Every person in this room, if they had to bet their license on whether litigation was going to ensue, would, I submit, that litigation was going to ensue. And to say that's a mere subjective belief just because the jet crashed and all 500 people perished really is at odds with what we all know reality to be.
Where would you ever draw the line if there's been an accident? If there's a slip and fall at a grocery store, you go get statistics on how many of those instances result in a case? Or?
Are we talking now just about party communications, Mr. Chief Justice?
Yes, we're just talking about party communications.
It is not easy to know where to draw the line on party communications because party communications, unlike attorney work product, do not necessarily have an attorney brought into the loop. But the test, I think, generally is whether there was a subjective belief that litigation would ensue. And secondly, I submit that as long as that subjective belief is proved, and that subjective belief was not unreasonable under the circumstances, and that subjective belief was really what engendered the communications, as opposed to just routine business communications that they would have had whether they anticipated litigation or did not anticipate litigation, that satisfies the test.
Make communications and then it later turns out there's a lawsuit, that it's privileged. But if nobody ever bothers to file a lawsuit, then it would not be.
No, I don't believe that's correct. You might reasonably anticipate litigation and to your great amazement and surprise, no litigation ever gets filed.
Right.
Now, of course, in those circumstances, I suppose nobody's asking for discovery, so
right.
It's a moot point. But certainly the fact that litigation later ensues is not self-fulfilling prophecy that will fit the bill. But I think a reasonable test whereby, first, was there a subjective belief of litigation, and was that what caused the communications to be made? And secondly, although 166B3D doesn't even include this in its language, some sort of test is, was that subjective belief reasonable in circumstances? Ought to suffice for purposes of party communication.
So you're asking us to overrule Flores?
I'm not asking that.
Don't we have to overrule Flores to accept your standard?
With respect to party communications, yes. With respect to attorney work product, no, because Flores did not address attorney work product.
We want to, you want us to overrule Stringer and overrule Flores. Is that right?
I don't, you don't need to overrule Flores to hold that attorney work product is not.
But if we reach your party communications issue, we do.
I'm not saying that you necessarily do. We had affidavits from Alan Pease, the general counsel, from Mr. Sneed, who was the adjuster at the insurer, going into extensive detail about their background. I don't know that Flores has to be read as courts of appeals have read it, saying that, party communications privilege is somehow dependent on what the plaintiff or potential plaintiff does.
How many courts of appeals opinions do we need to disapprove?
You would certainly need to disapprove Star Telegram versus Chapman. You would need to probably disapprove Department of Mental Health versus Davis. I believe you'd have to approve Sterling Drilling Company versus Spectre.
Approve it or disapprove?
Disapprove, excuse me. And I don't know how many others, but there have been several. They have been, for the most part, recent. And I think they have made the same basic mistake with respect to Flores that the Courts of Appeals made with respect to Allen v. Humphrey, which again discussed party communications, in which the Court of Appeals, as here, without much discussion, have said, well, that also applies to attorney work product. Now, of course, if you look at Rule 166b3, subsection A, governing attorney work product, says nothing about anticipation of litigation, in contrast to subsection C and D, which both have that language.
Well, following up on your answer to Justice Phillips, if every grocery store in the state simply has a pre-printed accident reporting form that says use this form only if you anticipate that there's a possibility from a slip and fall that occurs in the store that there might be litigation, won't that take care of it? And ensure that those incident reports are never disclosed to anybody?
Well, I think that would get into a question, at the very least, of who's making the determination. If you just have some store clerk who goes and fills out the form and he has no real basis for anticipating whether litigation is going to ensue or not, well, arguably that's not reasonable.
Under your example about the crash of the jumbo jet, if some maintenance worker does the same thing at the DFW airport, how do you distinguish that between that and the slip and fall at the HEB?
I will be very frank. I do not have a bright line test with respect to the party communications privilege. I believe that you would have to look at the authority of the person, the background of the person making the decision as to whether, one, that person has any basis for even knowing whether litigation is likely to sue and sue, and second, whether it's a reasonable opinion under the circumstances. I think the principal problem has been those courts of appeals decisions. Boring and Tunning versus Salazar is one which says that when the defendant can claim the party communications privilege depends entirely on what the potential plaintiff does or does not do after the incident. And as we pointed out, there was a mandamus from Corpus Christi which was denied both in the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals and in this court, where discovery was sought of an insurance company file. And the insurance company said, oh, no, we did that investigation for a possible subrogation claim. We were the plaintiffs or potential plaintiffs. They hadn't filed the subrogation claim even at that time. Therefore, we don't have to satisfy the objective prong of Flores because we were a potential plaintiff rather than a defendant. We didn't have to rely on what somebody else might do. We were the ones who would have initiated the action. And the court denied discovery on that basis.
How much of the documents that you contest come under either attorney-client or work product, in your opinion?
In my opinion, they all come under attorney-client, and they all come under work product. And that brings us to a very central issue.
Well, your time is up, so somebody has to ask you the central issue.
What is the central issue?
Thank you. It has been contended that when attorneys or agents of attorneys conduct investigations, they are somehow acting as investigators rather than as attorneys. We submit squarely that when attorneys conduct investigations, they are acting as attorneys, and so are their agents are acting as agents of attorneys.
Is there any Texas authority on this point?
Not that I'm aware of.
You're saying that by the mere fact that they have a license, even though there are no mental impressions, or opinions involved, anything the attorney does is protected?
Any fact
that the attorney discovers or any fact that the attorney observes, he cannot testify because he's an attorney?
I'm talking about attorney-client communication, Justice Gonzalez. That was within my answer. The other question is whether somebody who is conducting an investigation that works for the client is somehow acting on legal advice. And I submit that if the attorney advises the client, you need to conduct an investigation and you need to do the following things in the following way, those people who work for the client who conduct that investigation or cooperate with that investigation are acting on legal advice at that point. And that satisfies the requirements of Texas Rule of Civil Evidence 503 in that respect.
Any other questions?
Yes. Counsel, using your jumbo jet question, if 500 people are killed, isn't the only question not whether there will be litigation, but when the lawyers from out of state will arrive?
Yes, Mr. Justice Cook, I'd say that's about the only question open at that point.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Lee and Mr. Oldham will present arguments for the respondent. Mr. Lee will open. Mr. Oldham has reserved 5 minutes at the end.
May it please the court, I'm Michael Lee. My client in the trial court and here today is Bonded Inspections Incorporated, a non-destructive metal inspection service company that is headquartered in Garland. I address the court today on behalf of the respondent Robert Brotherton, the trial judge, the presiding judge at the 30th Judicial District Court. I'm going to take approximately 15 minutes of our argument on behalf of Judge Brotherton. Charles Oldham, the attorney for Helm Inspection Service Company, also a non-destructive metal inspection service company, will also address the court for about 5 minutes on behalf of Judge Brotherton.
Let me ask you a question before you start. Is there any dispute that you know who these witnesses are? They've been identified, and you've deposed these witnesses. So there is nothing here with regards to any information about undue hardship, substantial need to get this information. You already know who the witnesses are, and you've already deposed them.
We know the witnesses who have been identified. We have deposed those witnesses, yes. Is there someone else reflected in the reports or in those witness statements which have not been turned over?
Well, didn't you ask
them? We don't know.
Have you asked the witnesses that you deposed that question?
Anytime there's been any question, and those questions were generally, directed to Henry Townsend and to Don Hatfield concerning any contents of what were in the reports or the statements, objection was made.
Well, you've asked a question in one form or another about all persons that have knowledge of.
Yes, we have, Your Honor. And I'm not suggesting that NACO...
Do you agree or disagree with the characterization that these investigators were permitted to testify as to everything they saw and perceived? They simply were not permitted to testify as to the conclusions they drew from that they passed on.
I do not completely agree with that assertion. In this respect, once we got a few hours beyond the explosion, when we began to question Mr. Hatfield and Mr. Townsend concerning their subsequent actions, objection was made. They were not permitted to testify. I believe that is in the record on the motion for emergency relief the reply that we filed on behalf of Respondent Brotherton with the excerpts of the deposition. Once we got a few hours following the accident, the relator prohibited us from inquiring by way of objection as to Mr. Hatfield's and Mr. Townsend's further investigatory actions, so therefore we were not able to find out what they did observe, smell, see, hear.
Counsel, are you saying that you are unable to take a full, complete, and accurate deposition unless you can have someone else's statement as a guideline counted?
I'm not suggesting that at all, Your Honor.
Do you agree with the statement that neither the attorney-client privilege nor the work product privilege have any contemporary anticipation of litigation requirement attached to them.
As to the attorney-client privilege, it is clear that anticipation of litigation, I believe it is clear that anticipation of litigation is not one of the requisite tests for the attachment of that privilege.
How about work product?
As to work product, this court, to my knowledge, has not specifically addressed that. However, the courts of appeals have. And those courts of appeals have held, I think if you interpret their opinions the way they were intended to be interpreted, they have held that there is, in order for the work product privilege to attach, an anticipation of litigation standard. And
was Owens Corning, did our opinion in Owens Corning speak to that in any way?
I don't believe the opinion in Owens Corning spoke to that. The opinion in Owens Corning, as I interpret it, deals with the perpetuity of the work product privilege as it exists once it's work product.
Counsel, your client has filed an affidavit relating to objective manifestations, I guess, of to try to meet the or counter the Flores test to show when the defendant should have reasonably anticipated litigation. Is that correct?
My client has not filed any such affidavit.
I'm sorry.
Are we talking about the affidavit of
Deborah
Wilson?
Yes, I beg your pardon.
She was the plaintiff, is the plaintiff in this matter.
Okay. And when do you contend that the objective prong of the Flores test, what that date is?
Personally, I contend that the objective prong was sometime in January of 1991. The trial court determined the objective prong to have been met on the date that Frank Krupa served his lawsuit to NATCO, which was October 25 of 1990, and that is the date which we have used in our reply as the date the objective test was met.
Well, I want to ask you about that because on page 8 and 9 it set out the court's order. And it says, based on the court taking judicial notice of the district clerk's file and the return of citations filed in the lawsuit by Krupa against NATCO, such date is determined to be August 25, 1990. It's unclear to me if that was the date the papers were served or the date the return was filed.
It is clear that October 25, 1990. It's clear from the record that was transcribed from the hearing that of the hearing of the motions that are the subject of this mandamus, that October 25, 1990 is the date that NATCO was served.
Date they were served?
The date they were served.
Well, then that leads me to my next question. Under Flores requires both proof of an objective and subjective prong, and the trial court in effect held that their litigation could not reasonably have been anticipated until the date that the defendant, or until the date the citation return was filed in the district court's records. Certainly, the date that the lawsuit was filed, plaintiff reasonably anticipated litigation, right?
Mr. Krupa did.
Mr. Krupa did.
Which was another plaintiff in another suit.
Arising out of the same
incident. Out of the same incident.
Right. And so the trial judge is picking the date October 25, 1990 is not based on any application of the Flores test, is it?
I believe it is. That is the date on which NATCO 1 first received notice of something objective that would lead to the subjective reasonable anticipation of litigation.
Well, presumably citation was served, and then the officer had to go, had to file the return in the district clerk's office, and that ordinarily, in my experience, is not accomplished on the same day.
October 25, 1990, the record shows, is the date that NATCO was served with citation and petition in the Frank Krupa lawsuit.
Okay. That's not clear to me. It appears from the order that Judge Brotherton signed that was the date that the return of citation was filed in the district clerk's office, but if I'm incorrect, I'm incorrect.
I believe if you will look at the record of the proceeding that was had on these motions, you will find that it is clear in that record that is the date that NAFCO was served. NAFCO's motion for emergency relief, NAFCO's petition for writ of mandamus, and even NAFCO's argument a few moments ago tries to skip over, gloss over, one of the most important theories behind a mandamus action, namely that NAFCO has to establish that there was a clear abuse of discretion by Judge Brotherton. NAFCO asks this court, and has done so forcefully both in its petition for writ of mandamus and an argument a few moments ago, to change the law.
How about the fact that the judge made an error in law, that he missed his, with regards to privilege? So we're not talking about abuse of discretion in the sense that he had choices to make, either or several choices, but he just misconstrued the law as to privilege. And under Packer, isn't that one of the basis for a mandamus?
If, in fact, that were NAFCO's argument, I could accept that. That would be a clear basis for mandamus relief, that the trial court did make an error of law. But NAFCO is not coming here saying, generally speaking, that Judge Brotherton made an error of law.
Well, aren't they saying that this was all protected? They just said it was all protected by work product or attorney-client, and attorney-client is what they said, both of them, and that neither one of those have an anticipation litigation requirement. Now, you say it's not clear on work product, but they say every document's attorney-client, and that's because you extend the attorney-client privilege down the line to investigators, and that we all agree there's no anticipation requirement there. So that would be an error of law.
But if we look at the law as it exists through court opinions through today.
Yes, but we can...
This court can change the law.
We can change and retroactively apply it as we did in Lunsford. And I think what I'm more interested in, I believe what the court's more interested in, is there do appear to be several undetermined points here, which I wish you would address, starting with... attorney-client and work product, to what extent can you rely on subordinates who don't have the degree and the communications can have the privilege under Rule of Evidence 503, and then going into work product and whether or not it anticipates or not, and then finally, if time allows, into this whole problem of what's objective notice.
As to, if I may address the objective notice. First,
understanding we might
quickest.
Not get to that point if we're right.
I think it's quickest in that I think it is clear on this record that Judge Brotherton did not make a clearly erroneous ruling when he chose the October 25, 1990 date. That was a finding of fact by him on this record. I think he was free to choose October 25, 1990. I think he was free to choose a January date.
Isn't that irrelevant? So if anticipation litigation is not a requirement of work product is absolute, so what that date is irrelevant. It's the work product.
Courts of appeals have not said that.
But since we have not written on that issue, not an open question.
It is an open question. As to the attorney-client privilege, the Austin Court of Appeals addressed almost exactly analogous facts in Department of Mental Health and Retardation, Mental Health and Mental Retardation versus Davis. And in fact, I did some research and found that this court was presented with a mandamus against the Third Court of Appeals in which Judge Davis was subsequently made a respondent, and this court overruled the department's request for mandamus relief in March of 1991. In that case, there was a severe drowning. The legal services director for the department immediately was informed of this drowning, just as NAPCO claims that Alan Pease did, the legal services director formed the opinion that there was a virtual certainty of litigation. He therefore directed subordinates to conduct an investigation, to direct the results of that investigation to him and to him only, and that, his affidavit said, he was to use that investigation for the purpose of him and the Attorney General defending the department and the state. A number of statements were obtained by these subordinates, and several reports were made by the subordinates to the legal services director. The department made the identical arguments, namely that attached the attorney-client privilege, and number two, that work product protected those documents from disclosure. The Austin Court of Appeals discussed Rule 503, and it basically has three prongs. Number one, there must be communications to or from a lawyer, to or from a client. They must be made for the purpose of facilitating the rendition of professional legal services to the client, and the communications must be intended to be confidential. Well, NAPCO, just as the Department of Human Services did, or Mental Health and Retardation did, NAPCO has set forth enough to establish confidentiality. But as to the prong of the communications being made for the purpose of facilitating professional services to the client, the department, or the Court of Appeals in the Department of Mental Health and Retardation versus Davis basically said, and I believe this court should hold the same way with regard to Alan Pease's actions, that the legal services director was not acting as a lawyer. He was not conducting this investigation for the purpose of rendering professional services to the client. Instead, he was acting as an investigator. He was acting, in essence, as the clearinghouse, an overall adjuster, who was conducting an investigation, not performing legal professional services.
What did they say about work product?
As to work product, it's my recollection that the Davis Court was one of the courts that held that there had to be the anticipation of litigation for the work product doctrine to attach.
What is the basis of that? It's not in the rule.
Flores and Stringer.
Flores does not speak to work product.
I
agree. So where did they get it? Were they being sloppy? Well, they just made it up?
Star Telegram versus Chapman said the same thing.
I know. I'm very well aware of those cases. Where are they getting it?
Where did they get it? I cannot answer that.
Do you, and others that might answer this when they come up, since we're going to have to be looking at these things from a policy standpoint, do you have any law review articles, treatises, any authorities from other states, federal authorities, federal courts invented work product, that would be helpful to us in deciding from a policy standpoint whether this is work product or not, and if so, when work product should be able to attach?
I do not, but I would be happy to provide a supplemental brief to provide that to the court.
Well,
if the court were to so direct.
I'd be happy to read it.
All right.
If they do desire to do so within the next 2 weeks.
As to the three insurance reports, I think it's clear that those fall outside any of the protected privileges. NAPCO asserts that Mr. Sneed and Mr. Precht were conducting this investigation at the direction of Alan Pease, the general counsel. Yet in one of NAPCO's briefs before this court, they give a long explanation about how an insurance company, by the terms of its liability and indemnity policy, has a strict obligation to perform an investigation in good faith of the incident. That, in fact, is what Mr. Precht and Mr. Sneed were doing. They were conducting the investigation pursuant to the terms of the liability policy issued by the insurance company to NACTO. They were reporting to Mr. Alan Peace, apparently with the intent to keep those reports confidential. We submit to the court that if the court allows this sort of scheme to be applied, then in every single situation in which an insurance company desires to keep its post-accident investigation from day one confidential, it need only hire a lawyer to be the representative of the insured in the event that there is litigation and that the results of that investigation be directed to that lawyer on an alleged confidential basis. NACTO has developed a scheme, it seems to us, to simply subvert the rule that general post-accident investigation, either by a company or by its insurer, should be discoverable, at least until we reach the point that there is an outward manifestation that leads to a true subjective belief that litigation is imminent.
If that were true, would it be, from a strategic point of view, from a plaintiff's side, you would delay any outward manifestation for a couple of years and let them investigate the case for you, and then everything is available to you?
Keep in mind, the same thing would apply to you then, because all of your investigation as the plaintiff, unless there is an outward manifestation given by the defendant that leads to a reasonable anticipation of litigation.
So you believe the case about the subrogation, the insurance company is subrogated, was wrong?
I do.
Why else would an insurance company investigate an accident other than in anticipation of a claim of some sort, except in a subrogation context?
Anticipation of a claim? No other reason. Anticipation of litigation? Most claims do not turn into litigation, and that is the reason.
Well,
the
claims are not paid. Most of them turn into litigation, don't they?
That is correct, but as long as we're going to have the rule that general post-accident investigation is not privileged generally until there is an anticipation of litigation, then that's the law. I mean, most claims do not become litigation.
Any other questions? Thank you, Judge. Is there time left for Mr. Oldham?
There was supposed to be 5 minutes reserved, Mr. Chief Justice.
Did you reserve it?
They went through the time.
The light came on?
There was a question.
Yeah, the court will allow Mr. Oldham about 5 minutes of that.
I'm here representing HESCO in part, although of course both of us are basically representing all of the parties who want this information. But my particular client, Helm Inspection.
Does the plaintiff want this information, or does the plaintiff want this information, or is this solely?
Initially, the plaintiff wanted the information. Now, I think they're kind of in between. They don't seem to know whether they want it or not.
They cut a deal with the other side?
What?
They cut a deal with the other side? They've already been paid, or what's the situation?
NACTO has settled with this particular plaintiff totally. The other people that NACTO is representing, which is Incotech and Mr. Engelman, there's been an announcement that there has been a settlement, but no settlement papers have been produced. You'll see in some of this records, it's our argument that they should not even be here or even in the lawsuit, but we can't get the papers as to what the settlement was, so we don't know what peculiar settlement they have that keeps them in the case. I represent HISCO, which is Helm Inspection Service. It is an institution that would not have been around more than 40 or 50 years ago, because all we do is go out to be sure that the people who are supposed to be checking are doing it honestly. In other words, the bonded people, they go out and they test this tank. All we do is for the end purchaser, Exxon, we come out and watch bonded to be sure that bonded is not cheating anybody in the test. All we do is observe that. And in this particular case, we even had an independent contractor out there doing our part. It's our position in this that certainly on the communication portion, and we feel actually on the work product, that there does have to be an objective manifestation. And in this sense, I think this is what Bonded was saying, is that the judge under those circumstances, the trial judge, has to make a decision, a factual decision, as to when that occurs. He can listen to the testimony and he has to factually decide, and the appellate courts in this court can second guess him if he's in breach of the discretionary duties along that line. He decided that at the time that the first lawsuit was served, that was the time of the objective manifestation. And that lawsuit is not even the one that this is involved in. That's the lawsuit that is still pending, but I'm, for instance, not even a party to it.
Do you agree with Mr. Lee's observation that knowing there's going to be a claim is in no way an objective manifestation of a lawsuit?
Under the case law, I don't think it is. As
well, I mean, that would, it seemed to me, would not give a defendant much incentive to enter into bargaining with a claimant, because it, I mean, at least there would be some disincentive here, because that would lengthen the time in which your investigations might be.
If all is needed is that somebody thinks there's going to be a lawsuit subjectively, I assure you that in just about every case, there's going to be that subjective belief.
Well, I wasn't asking that question. I was asking if knowing there's a claim, somebody says, we'd like $400,000 to go away, and you say, I think about it, is that enough or is that not enough to meet the Forrest test?
Of course, in this case, they didn't have that.
I understand, but
now, if we're talking about generalities, as one of the judges here knows, I suddenly find myself in a peculiar position. I've been an insurance defense attorney for 31 years, and I probably, over those years, think that there's more that should be able to be kept in the files than is being allowed to be kept. But the way the rule is written, I'd have to say that just stating that they're talking to them is not really enough. I think there's even a comp case that says when you file a claim before the board, that's not enough. And to me, that's certainly more than just orally telling somebody that you'd like some money. Obviously, any time when you get in a case with insurance, the adjuster is going to go out there, and the claimant's going to talk to the adjuster, and they're going to talk to at least some degree about whether there is a claim or not a claim. And seldom does the claimant ever say he's not making a claim that I'm aware of. So if that's the rule, it would all be frivolous as a practical matter.
Saying there's a big distinction between recognizing a potential for litigation and anticipating litigation.
Tremendous, because the way the world is right now, anytime there's any kind of accident, there's obviously potential because 9 out of 10 of them are going to result in at least a claim, if not a lawsuit.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Court, Mr. Lee misperceives what NATCO is contending in this matter. NATCO is contending that there were errors in the application of the law by Judge Brotherton in his orders. And at the outset, I do want to say there has been no argument and no support for any showing or any showing that there was any undue hardship or substantial need by the real parties in interest for this information. What we have here is real parties in interest trying to take a shortcut to obtain information which is otherwise available to them. Approximately 35 depositions have been taken in this case. They have either obtained the facts or they've had an opportunity to obtain the facts. Now, with respect to the orders by Judge Brotherton, I think that they reflect the confused state of the law of privileges in this state. And it is time for some clarification. The first order required production of any investigative reports of the incident and each written and oral statement prior to the time of NATCO's actual knowledge of the filing of a lawsuit. And the second order required Mr. Townsend and Mr. Hatfield to testify in regard to conversations, including any conversations with me or with NATCO's general counsel, Alan Pease. It didn't specify that as much, but it said that any communications they had were not privileged with any party.
As far as the first category is concerned, these documents, the statements and the like that you ordered to produce?
Yes, Judge.
Did the trial judge do an in-camera examination of those before ordering their production?
They were made available to Judge Brotherton, and I presume that he did examine them.
And they're part of our record also? They are part of the record here in camera also?
Yes, Judge, they've been submitted to
the... Would you agree that in order for us to make the determination and resolve these arguments, that this court needs to carefully review the in-camera documents to see that they comport with the arguments you're advancing?
Well, I think that based upon the affidavits we have submitted, frankly, the privileges we have asserted have been established. If we didn't have any independent evidence to prove that the documents were privileged, then one might have to resort to the documents themselves. But that is not the case in this case, because through our affidavits, I believe we've established each and every privilege that we've asserted. Now, both of the orders that Judge Brotherton entered were premised upon two findings. The first, that there were no outward manifestations which indicated litigation was imminent. That was in his order. And the second order relied on that same finding. That is not the test. They also found that the communications between Don Hatfield and Henry Townsend and any other party were not privileged as attorney-client communications. Now, those findings in that order ignores our assertions of attorney work product privilege, and as I've said, it employs the wrong test. The test is not when there were outward manifestations which indicated litigation was imminent. And a lot of the questions have been directed towards that. Even under Flores, that is not the test. The objective test under Flores is when an objective examination of the facts surrounding an investigation indicates that litigation can reasonably be anticipated.
So the subjective test and objective test essentially be satisfied by the same sort of recognition of the inevitability of the lawsuit?
Well, frankly, I believe that's correct. I also believe that the objective test is wrong. But it is the test used in Flores, and the issue is whether, based upon an objective examination of all the facts surrounding an accident, you can anticipate that litigation will ensue.
If there isn't an objective test, how would, say, a hospital incident reports that it routinely fills out, the nurse fills out after a minor incident, let's say, in a hospital, how would those ever be subject to discovery when they are routine reports and not filled out in anticipation of litigation?
Well, as my esteemed co-counsel pointed out, I think the issue there would be whether it was reasonable to anticipate that litigation would ensue based upon an examination of the circumstances.
Well, wouldn't that basically leave it up to the trial judge in each and every instance, because all we would do to see whether the trial judge abused his or her discretion in making that decision about that issue? In other words, we'd have to defer to the trial judge in each and every instance whether the nature of the accident, perhaps the propensities of the or the proclivities of the injured party, all the circumstances were such that it would that litigation could be reasonably anticipated.
Well, I just think that depends on whether, based upon the evidence, the judge abused his discretion in determining that it was reasonable to anticipate litigation would ensue. Certainly, under an objective standard, the court would have more opportunity, I think, to evaluate the judge's conduct. So, if that answers your question.
Yeah, I think so. So if merely a subjective test is used in almost in every conceivable instance, except perhaps where the trial judge said litigation would not be anticipated when a jumbo jet crashed or some explosion, or perhaps you would contend in this instance, it would always be decided by the trial judge and there would never be any opportunity for appellate to review.
Well, frankly, I do. I think that you have to look at the accident. You have to look at the circumstances. And based upon the accident and the circumstances, and then based upon the evidence supporting a party's position that they anticipated litigation would ensue. And I would add that the party communication privilege simply says in anticipation. It doesn't even say the anticipation has to be reasonable. And, you know, arguably, if you assert and prove that you anticipated litigation will ensue, that should end the inquiry. And frankly, that's how I think the law should be. But to the extent that's not acceptable, and a reasonable anticipation test is adopted, if you examine...
That's a self-fulfilling prophecy, is it not? In other words, if the litigant could always say that I anticipated litigation, and if the law... privilege will not be asserted except in the context of a lawsuit, so it will always be privileged.
It is a potential problem with respect to just a straight anticipation without some reasonable anticipation requirement.
When is it not reasonable to expect litigation to ensue, whether it's a slip and fall, an intersection collision, a plane crash?
Mr. Justice, quite frankly, I think the situations where it wouldn't be reasonable would be countless. And the situations where it would be reasonable also would be countless.
But how do we know without some outward manifestation, without some objective standard, what are we to do? We can't crawl inside the skulls of the parties and determine when and if it became reasonable or when and if it was unreasonable.
There's a distinction between an objective analysis of all the facts and circumstances surrounding an accident and an outward objective manifestation of intent to imminently file a lawsuit.
When you start dealing with an examination, objective examination of all the facts and circumstances, you're inherently strapped with subjective perception. So what we need is some objective standard that manifests itself, or some objective measure for all the world to see, if you will.
Quite frankly, in a certain respect, I don't disagree with you. The objective standard certainly could be an objective analysis of all the facts and circumstances surrounding an accident, as opposed to having to rely on the tactical strategic advantage that a plaintiff has in waiting up to 2 years before he sends a demand letter, threatens litigation, or files suit. That is unfair, it's inequitable, and it really does deny potential defendants equal protection, I think, under the privilege laws. And, you know, I would simply submit that this particular accident, in which involves serious injury to three people employed by three separate companies, two of whom were independent contractors, one of these individuals later died, is really a more extreme version of a case where you have a collision between not just two, but three freight trains owned by different railroad companies, resulting in serious injury. And again, I submit that in that situation, it does blink reality for one not to expect reasonably and objectively that litigation will ensue.
Any other questions?
All right. That concludes the argument in both clauses. The foregoing clauses are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. And the marshal will now please adjourn the court.
The audience will please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas.